Evening. Good evening, you all. I'm K2 Romeo India Whiskey. My name is Dick. Along with Mel, K2 Kilo Echo Yankee, the two of us try to orchestrate a thing called the Technical Net, which education takes place. Information gets transferred. The ham radio operators gather the clan. They share their knowledge on their favorite way of doing ham radio. What's their favorite antennas and transmitters and receivers and propagation and modes of operation and so on. There's 26 different kinds of ham radio. We try to cover quite a few of those from time to time. The subjects that are discussed are primarily the subjects that are brought to the TechNet by people with questions. Occasionally, Mel will have a special program on like decibels or antennas or the Smith chart. And if we have a real low in the conversation tonight, I'm going to tell you something about radio propagation that is highly misunderstood. Came to my attention this week. A person signs into the Technical Net by giving Mel and Dick your call letters, your name, and the word yes, which means you do have a question or a comment for the net. Do we have any check-ins at the time? Please give me your call letters and name right now.
Alpha Charlie 2 Alpha Zulu, this is Bob, yes.
Okay, so far we've got Bob. Anyone else?
You mean 2RY, yes.
Okay, that was Joe. So we got Bob and Joe so far. Anyone else?
KC2MDP, Steve, no questions.
Steve with a no. Anyone else?
N2Alpha Sierra Sierra Mobile with a no question.
Alpha Sierra Sierra, very unique set of calls. What is your name, sir?
Oh, I'm Greg. We've spoke before.
Very fine, Greg. I talk to a lot of people, and I don't keep all the names straight, as you can tell. One last call. Anyone else have to check into the TechNet? Give me your call letters and name at this time. Okay. Maybe we'll have more people checking in later. Bob, Alpha Charlie 2 Alpha Zulu, what would you like to talk about?
Quick question on a G5RV. Does the twin lead need to be straight? The twin lead going up to the center of the antenna is part of the antenna. Does it have any effect if it's twisted going up and down, or it just doesn't make any difference?
A nice thing about twin lead is that although it looks very open, whether it be 600 ohm open wire line, 450 ohm ladder line, 300 ohm twin lead, television set, or whatever, until you get up to some extremely high frequencies where the spacing between the wires becomes an appreciable portion of a wavelength, like on 1296 megahertz, 600 ohm open wire line starts radiating because you're now you're getting close to the wavelength as the spacing of the wires. But until then, you may think it's part of the antenna, and as far as impedance matching is concerned, yes, it is. As far as radiation is concerned, absolutely not. That is as well shielded a transmission line as your coax cable. It's hard to believe, even though it looks so open to your eye, because when you're using it in the balanced manner, the current flowing up the right-hand wire and the current flowing down the left-hand wire at that particular instant of time are thoroughly balanced. They're opposite in position and direction. No radiation takes place. What little radiation would have taken place from one of those wires is completely canceled by the other, which radiates is co-located. Yeah, they're really an inch or 3 inches apart, but radio-wise, wavelength-wise, they're co-located. So no radiation takes place from that twin lead portion of the Lou Varney antenna, the G5RV. Those who want the last little bit of isolation between the transmission line and the outside world will intentionally twist the wire. You don't really have to do it, but those who want that last little bit, I mean, if there's a tiny bit of radiation from the open wire line or twin lead, by twisting it and the number of twists every wavelength, well, a little bit of radiation happens on one twist, gets canceled by the other one because of the 180-degree phase shift, because of the twist. people have done for years, and it has no effect on the transmission. And since this is not a radiator, it'll have no effect on the radiation. About the only thing you have to worry about with twin lead is that if you lay it against a metallic surface, you're changing the impedance in that area. If you do it for a short enough number of wavelengths, there's no great interference. But if I was using twin lead at 432 megacycles and for a foot and a half...
Repeater, time out.
If for a foot and a half I laid it up against a piece of metallic ductwork, I would be seriously interfering with the way the twin lead is being used. I would have a brand new impedance in that area. And that could be good or bad. Most of the time it's bad, because by Murphy's Law, when you've created a different impedance, you never, rarely do you ever hit just the right number of wavelengths that it all comes out right. If you have a even number, if you have a number of half wavelengths of disturbed impedance, everything comes out right. In other words, I could have a piece of 50 ohm cable. In the middle of the 50 ohm cable, I splice in a piece of 75 ohm cable. And at the end of the 75 ohm cable, I splice in a piece of 50 ohm cable. If on my operating frequency, that intermediate 75 ohm piece of cable, if it was a half wavelength long or an exact multiple of a half wavelength long, nothing would happen. Because every half wavelength of transmission line repeats whatever impedance is on the end, gets repeated on the input. You get the exact opposite if it's a quarter wavelength long. You get what's called impedance inversion. So things change. But if it was a half wavelength or one wavelength or one and a half wavelength, multiples of a half wavelength, you can get away with murder. So as you can see, you got a good question there, Bob. I think you got nothing to worry about. You're probably intentionally twisting it, or it happened in the process of installation, and you're worried, is it going to change the performance? I think absolutely not. Alpha Charlie 2, Alpha Zulu, K2RIW in the TechNet.
Thanks for that, Dick. My biggest concern was the fact that the twin lead is part of the antenna, at least in terms of matching. I've seen pictures and diagrams of how the G5RV matches all the bands, and the twin lead is part of it. I was just wondering if there was any effect there because it was twisted. Thank you. K2RIWAC2AZ.
Bob, out of curiosity, your twin lead is twisted because you intentionally did that, or it happened by accident? Go ahead.
Oh, kind of threw it out the window routine, you know, just hung it up there and just let it drop down and then ran the coax into the house. And looking out the window, I'm looking at it today and seeing it's twisted, and I'm thinking, maybe I'll ask that technician and see if they have an answer as to whether or not it's going to affect anything.
I think the answer is absolutely not. But if at some later time you untwist it and you remeasure standing wave ratio, with bands of operation, gain, whatever, if you do see any kind of a change, come back and let us know about it. But I'm pretty sure you're not going to see a change. Good luck with that project. Joe, W2R1Y, I don't think we heard from you last week. Took attendance last week and you weren't there. Oh, yes, you were. Yes, you were. Oh, I see your name listed here. And what's the latest on direction finding in your neighborhood, Joe? W2RYY, K2RIW.
10-2 Alpha Sierra Sierra, I just want to let you know that the east input unlinked for some reason in the middle of your text.
Okay, I'm going to let the machine drop for a full 20 seconds or so. Maybe that'll reset things. And if anyone out of area wants to check in, that also gives them the opportunity. So K2RIW, TechNet, Limog, we're going to pause for about 15 seconds. Looks like there's no one out of area to check in. Let me do a quick check and see if I can hear myself by going into the other input. Hello, 1, 2, 3, 4. I'm going to the eastern input, coming out of the western input, and I'm going to now invert the process. Hello, 1, 2, 3, 4. Okay, I'm now going into the western input, and listening to myself coming out of the eastern input. So as I see it, the whole system is operating correctly. But thank you for bringing that to our attention. Maybe it reset itself. Joe, you got it. W2RYY. What's happening in the Oakdale Spa area? You got it, Joe. Romeo 2, GTT.
I hear something come through.
Romeo 2, Tango, Tango, Tango. Whiskey 2, Tango, Tango, Tango. That sounds like Gordon. And what's new in New Jersey these days, Gordon? You got it.
Well, good evening, Dick, and everybody. Well, there's been a lot of discussion over, I think they're called differential attenuators. And some people have made observations that 2-meg offset, 4-meg offset have different qualities that they're a little imprecise about. One of them is that they're happier about the 4-meg offset on the 2-meter one because they don't want to be out of band. And of course, a lot of people, and therefore you won't fry the differential attenuator should you convert the transmit. As an attenuator, which makes better sense, I guess would be my question, for, you know, if I was going to use it with a handy talkie my receiver, which would make better sense, the 2-meg or the 4-meg type? Just got curious what you think about that, Dick. QRIW-2DT.
Okay, I heard your words reasonably well. A little bit of picket fencing. I'm listening to you simultaneously on the input and the out. And when you fade a little bit into Glen Oaks' machine, I'm hearing you up here in Huntington and vice versa. So I'm getting you 100% by hearing both sides. A differential attenuator, 2 megs or 4 megs of offset. I understand each of the words. I don't understand the concept. I've seen a so-called differential attenuator, which is an H-bridge attenuator of resistors or other kinds of components. In other words, you've got two leads coming in, two leads coming in. Okay, each of those leads have kinds of attenuator. I've heard that being called as a differential attenuator. However, when you say 2 megs and 4 megs of offset, and you say, I'm now confused. You're going to have to give us a few more words, Gordon, as to what product or object or technique you're talking about. W2TTT in New Jersey. And what parkway are you on? K2LIW.
Actually, Dick, I'm on a local road. I'm on. Just dumped a photo on my lap. Ouch, that hurt. All right. Actually, it didn't hurt. It just was cold. Anyway, big deal. I'll live. This thing is an active device that I guess has either a 2 meg or 4 meg IF or a 4 meg or an 8 meg IF. I guess it's 2 meg or 4 meg IF. A fundamental. There we go. Distracted here. And apparently it generates a signal that's near the one that you want to listen to, and then, you know, by essentially being desensed, I that's the way I understand it to work, that it allows you to get very close into this target transmitter and actually discern a direction. It's used to address the problem of being too close to the transmitting source.
Okay. If I was doing fox hunting, bunny hunting, and I'm worried that whatever I use as my attenuator to keep my signal strength meter from saturating, worrying about overriding it, or the signal feeding around it and going straight into the handy-talkie, so to speak. One solution to that would be to put the handy-talkie into some kind of a shielded cage. And now the attenuator is fed, the signal is being fed through a feed-through connector. So I can stop the handy-talkie from picking up the signal directly, and now I can plug in as many dB of attenuation as I can muster on the outside, as long as it's well shielded. That's one approach to doing extremely close fox hunting without overloading the receiver. I'll admit that that's a little bit for the average guy who hasn't actually run into that problem. Who manufactures a thing called a differential attenuator? Is it a commercial product? Or was this a article in one of the ham radio journals as to how to build this piece of hardware? Because I think I'm hearing about it for the first time, or at least I'm not recognizing it yet, Gordon. W2TTT K2LW.
Look, I know there's a product out there, there's a line of products out there, and one of guys on the TechNet here in New Jersey was referencing it. Actually, I didn't get to look it up and spend much time doing an evaluation of what was being talked about. I was kind of caught off guard somewhat the way you are, but 2 weeks ago, a bunch of guys got skunked big time at a fox hunt, and they were really, really close, a few hundred feet from the target, and they just couldn't get a bearing on the signal because of the way the topology was, not to mention certain buildings.
Well.
Okay, who is that just signed in?
K2YO, Bernie.
Very fine, Bernie. I'm going to turn it over to you in a second. One of the famous fox hunts that were held on Long Island, a guy used a Yagi antenna, aimed up at a water tower, and therefore almost everybody was getting the signal reflected off the water tower. And that drove them crazy. They just couldn't find the source of the signal. There was one other time when a guy positioned himself under a bridge, had a piece of coax cable going up to the bridge, and there was a dipole antenna parallel to one of the vertical wires of the bridge. So people were on the bridge, whizzing back and forth, knowing that they were passing the bunny, but there was no obvious bunny on that bridge. Well, the bunny was really the J-pole antenna that was hidden, and a coax cable draping over the side down to the automobile that was down underneath the bridge. Really drove them crazy. So it sounds to me like your guys over there in New Jersey did something equally tricky. Now, maybe Bernie knows something about this. K2 Yankee Oscar, you got it, Bernie. K2LAW.
Yeah, affirmative. They're called offset attenuators. Basically, it's a circuit that adds 4 megahertz, either adds or subtracts 4 megahertz to the signal, and then lets you attenuate from there. You then tune your receiver to that 4 megahertz offset tone. That way, you're not trying to read the actual signal coming out of the T. You're taking an offset of that, which eliminates much of the case bleed. If you go to homingin.com, find Joe Moll's website. He will have information on it. The club that belongs to California is where the guy worked that actually developed it. I'm not going to be able to come up with his name. That was almost 20 years ago. His last part of his call sign was 6OV, I believe. But anyway, there's a number of people that there's a number of designs on the internet for it. And there is also Aero Electronics that sells them. So you might want to look up Aero Antennas, go into their direction section, and they'll have them.
Okay, I can see how that's sort of a crafty idea, in that as long as your mixing device has a high enough dynamic range, it can tolerate very strong signals. It's mixing your unknown signal with, let's say, a 4 megasignal oscillator, and therefore out of that mixer comes a signal 4 megs above and 4 megs below the actual signal that's coming in. And because of the mixing process, it'll be a whole lot weaker. Therefore, you're listening to this weaker signal after it's been through the offset attenuator. Gordon called it a differential attenuator. Offset sounds like it's more reasonable. And now, any signal that bypasses all of that circuitry and goes straight into the handy is not going to affect the handy because the handy is tuned 4 megs away from the incoming signal. A fairly crafty idea. And I worry about its linearity and its sensitivity if the signal gets weak. If I had the choice of either constructing a offset attenuator or building a shielded cage for my handy talkie, I'm not sure which way I would go. I have enough faith in my ability to build a good shielded cage and my ability to connect it with good double shielded coax cable into a reasonably high quality step attenuator. I, for instance, have made measurements of the Montauk Point radar when it was 120 decibels above my threshold. I mean, the average receiver will saturate, give it a signal that's about 70 dB above threshold. And I measured one that was 50 dB stronger than that. It's just a matter of having the right kind of shielding, good coaxial connectors, and good step attenuators. So that's the direct approach, and the offset attenuator is the indirect approach, I'm going to call it. both work. Each has its advantages and disadvantages. So, sounds like homingin.com is maybe where this original piece of hardware came from. Let's turn it back to Gordon and see if he recognizes any of that. Whiskey 2, Tango, 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 K2IW in the segment.
K2KEY with the info on it.
And KC2QIQ.
Okay, hang in there, Gordon. We got both some guy named Mel and some guy named Glenn are going to tell us more about it. Mel first. Go ahead, Mel.
Okay, I've made such a thing. Actually, it's what they known as an active attenuator for VHF. Because your handy talkie normally has somewhere around, say, half scale on a handy talkie, full scale, is only a difference, say, 18 to about 31 dBs. By using this active attenuator, you can, well, as you said, one thing you did say, Dick, very important, is that you should shield the handy talkie when you're doing these type of fox hunting. But the active attenuator will give you a good response range over approximately 100 dB. And they're homebrewed, made it out of a couple transistors, and not a very complicated thing to put together in a little box. And quite effective when you're doing that kind of interesting RDF work, Dick, over.
Yeah, this reminds me a little bit about a person who doesn't use a 20 dB attenuator out of a signal generator when he's trying to measure the sensitivity of a really good receiver. A good signal generator might have an internal oscillator that's running at plus 10 dBm, 10 milliwatts. And you've set the dial in the front panel for minus 110 or minus 120 dB, bottom of the dial, so to speak. And you're asking for a total of 130 dB attenuation between the internal oscillator and the signal that you think is coming out of that front panel. Well, the shielding of the box that the signal generator is contained in may only be good for 100 or 110 dB of attenuation, and you're asking for 130 on the signal you're feeding out. And the bottom line is that if the device you're testing itself is not very well shielded, then there's a sneak path for the signal to walk straight out of the oscillator inside of your signal generator, right through the shielding of its box, and through the shielding of your device on the test. And that sneak path will give you some pretty crazy indications on what you think is the signal, the sensitivity of the system. So, and a handy talkie, some handy talkies with a rubber or hard plastic outer case have a only moderate amount of internal shielding. And so, in the presence of strong signal, the sneak path can easily dominate. Sir Glenn is running some of those things. KC2QIQ, K2RIW, very Glenn.
Yeah, good evening, Dick. Good evening, everybody on the net tonight. It's just what you said is completely valid, because my experience has been so far on the walk-ins. You know, I'll let the Doppler do the work in the car, and then when I get into the point to where I'm pulling out the HT, at that point, typically the antenna is off the HT, and I've got the SMA connector bare open as I start the walk-in, you know, towards the bunny to finally, you know, walk target, and I'm using the S meter on front of the HT, and generally I'm also using my body as the shield, so I'm holding the HT with the SMA connector in front of me, and with my body as a shield in back, and I can turn in different directions and see where I'm getting the largest signal strength, and then basically just walk in towards the target. What I found is that if I add anything, I know Andy's tried this, I've tried it, almost anything that you add to the SMA connector or to a VNC on the front of one of the HTs, it does nothing more than act as an antenna, even if there's nothing in front of it, just an attenuator. So actually to get the best attenuation is just almost to pull almost everything you have off of the front of the HT, and if anything, if that's not enough, add some shielding to the HT, which might even be better. Back to you, the K2RIW, KC2QIQ.
So by holding the handy talkie with a rubber duck antenna on it in front of you, and then spinning your body around, you'll watch the S meter go up and down, and the handy talkie will indicate which direction, because when your back is against the source, and your body acts as the attenuator, the S meter is the worst. So, aircraft. Let's see what Gordon's going to say about all this. W2, Tango, 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 KQI. LAW, you got to go ahead and...
Yeah, that sounds good. Sounds good. It is the opposite attenuator. I guess the only other question I'd have is the 2 or 4 megahertz offset. Some people suggest the 4 is better as you go higher in frequency, especially if you have to also deal with a 40 signal. It was better to have that because you wouldn't have such a ridiculously high harmonic to deal with. The other advantage of the 4 megahertz was that it wouldn't allow you to transmit into the device and thereby killing the device. Anyway, that's good. I'm going to listen out. I'm going to be in a no transmit zone here soon because of the quality of my signal. So thank you, Dick, and thank you, everybody else. That was very, very illuminating, as they say. G2RWW2TT.
If I understand the operation correctly of the offset or active attenuator, and differential attenuator as you called it, you're not using the harmonics intentionally of your 2 meg or 4 meg oscillator. The 2 meg or 4 meg oscillator is a local oscillator, so to speak. Let's say, for instance, I'm mixing in 146 megacycles, and by mixing in the 2 meg oscillator, out comes 144 and 148, 2 megs above and 2 megs below, by direct one-by-one mixing process. Yes, you got to be a little bit careful, is that if I choose the right combination of frequencies so that the umpty-umpt harmonic of my 2 meg oscillator happens to fall on the frequency I'm listening to, then you create your own kind of jamming. But it's not a real harmonic generator per se, if it's used in the pure form from the way I understand it. You're literally translating your incoming signal plus or minus 2 megacycles. And so if you've got a good enough synthesizer in your receiver, whether you use 2 megs of offset, 3 megs of offset, or 4 megs of offset, I don't think it matters a great deal. That's my gut feel. I'll admit that if the front end of your handy talkie has an extremely broad filter where it lets through, in my example, 144 and 148 simultaneously because it can't tune one versus the other, I guess you could get some pretty funny effects at times. So, I think both will work. I'd be hard pressed to figure out whether 2 megs or 4 megs is better. And I presume the actual 2 meg or 4 meg oscillator, in some cases, probably is a square wave generator, one of these crystal controlled oscillators from an old fashioned computer that used to run at 2 or 4 megs. That's one way of doing it. Anybody have any further questions or comments on the subject of the offset attenuator, or as Mel called it, the active attenuator? Give me your call letters right now. K2RIW in the TechNet.
KC2AZ.
Okay, we had a triple there, or at least a double. KC2AZ, that was the one person calling. Who was the other one?
K2KEY.
And Mel?
T-Y-O.
Okay, we got all three. we got Bob, Mel, and Bernie in that order. Go ahead, Bob.
Yeah, you blended me with Mel. It's AC2. You said KC2. Anyway, I'm sitting here going to... I went to that page that you described on the internet over there, and I'm looking at this device. And with the 4 megahertz oscillator, they're talking about tuning in to the mixed frequency, and they gave an example here, 146. Plus 4 puts you at 150 or down at 142. Do HTs tune that far of a range out of band? And the other thing, all the pictures of the home-built ones over here are in plastic boxes, which I would think is kind of defeating the purpose because a strong signal could get in there and bypass anything that you might have put together there. Anyway, that's looking at this, it just looks like a variable... amplitude local oscillator going to a diode mixer, and that's about it. AC2AZ.
In the case of an ICOM IC2AT handy talkie, the thumb wheel buttons will allow you to dial everything from 140 to 150 megacycles, and the active region is 144 to 148. If you remove a certain jumper inside, it will tune down to 140 and 141 and 142 megs. That's the good news. The bad news, when you go down there, out of the band, so to speak, for receiving purposes, it falls off very fast in sensitivity. Well, if you're the signals that feed around it are going to be the signal you're not listening to. Let's say, for instance, the signal is on 146, and you've got a 4-meg oscillator, so you're listening to 142, assuming your handy talkie or whatever you're using as the real receivable tuned to 142. There's no other way that 142 can take place except by getting through the mixer of the offset attenuator. So the fact that there's a lack of shielding is not necessarily a disadvantage. The whole idea of this offset attenuator is that the handy talkie doesn't have to be shielded, and the electronics that's doing the translation down there doesn't have to be shielded, because the frequency your receiver is listening to happens to be not a real frequency. It can only come about by way of that mixing action inside of the offset attenuator. I wonder if that makes some sense, Bob. Back to you, Bob, first, K2RIW.
That makes sense. But what's down at 142 and 150? Is there any, police band might be down somewhere around 150. 142, I know that's above the aircraft band, so I'm not sure what's in there, but maybe some local interference might give you a problem.
It might, but I'm going to make a guess that this offset attenuator is an extremely dead receiver, because that whole process is intended for you being, within 100 yards of the bunny, of the fox you're hunting. You've got extremely strong signal, so you could easily set that up so that it is a receiver with a 30 decibel noise figure, a really dead receiver, in which case, unless the offending signal happens to be a police radio and you're a fraction of a mile away from that police radio dispatching center, you're not going to hear it. On top of that, I own receivers that will tune those kind of frequencies. I've occasionally tuned down there when listening for local birdies from scanning receivers that used to be in my neighborhood. And except for the scanner birdies, I never heard anything else down there. It's a wide open territory. Up at 150, yes, you've got a number of commercial things going on there. But down at 142, I think in many areas of the country, it's a fairly unused area, so that could work pretty well. I think Mel was the next person. K2KUY, go ahead, Mel.
You know, that is bringing up a good point, that even if you have poor shielding in a handy talkie, by using this active attenuator, now I'm starting to think back what it was all about when I built it so many years ago, it actually achieves its continuous variable attenuation by mixing the received signal with a signal that from the oscillator, which is in there, which is a 500 kilohertz oscillator. So the mixing products, you know, are either above or below the input frequency. So what happens is that even with poor shielding, the result that the handheld transceiver will be usable for fox hunting, unless, of course, the blocking, the signal mixing product will exceed about 100 dB. Then the antenna range, the attenuation range is gone, really. So actually what you're doing is varying the level of the oscillator signal to control the strength of the input signal, Dick, based on that principle, over.
Fantastic. I see the way it works. So if I've got, say, for instance, a 500 kc, a 1 meg, 2 meg, or whatever oscillator, the offset oscillator, if that offset oscillator has itself something very simple, like a potentiometer, a simple pot between it and the input local oscillator terminal of your mixing device, and the mixing device maybe is nothing more than a 1N34 diode, but as I starve the mixer for less and less LO, the equivalent noise figure of that receiver mixer starts climbing real fast. So if the mixer really wants to see 0 dBm of LO and I give it minus 10, it's going to have another 20 dB of attenuation, so to speak, because it's a starved LO mixer. Whenever you take any doubly balanced mixer or any other kind of mixer and give it an improper amplitude of local oscillator, particularly on the weak side, the mixing function, the insertion loss of that mixer, starts climbing real fast. And in this case, you're using that to an advantage. So a simple potentiometer limiting the local oscillator takes the place of a high-precision, 146 megacycle attenuator. And you don't have to worry about the shielding or the stray reactances of the switching function of that attenuator. A simple pot will do it. That's a very crafty circuit, the more I hear about it. I'm guessing as to the way it works, and I wonder if I'm close, Mel. K2KEY, K2LIW.
Just about exact. Okay, because I remember one time we went on a bunny hunt. The input frequency was 146.52 simplex, and the mixing product, the closest mixing product, being you're basing it on the 500 kilohertz, was either here at 147.02 or 146.02. So this way, as you say, by adjusting the pot, you are actually beginning to starve the oscillator, and in that way, even in the presence of every strong signal, that will, well, you know, it could be as high as 120 dB, but with this attenuator, being able to attenuate 100 dB, you're back down now to a 20 dB gain onto a transceiver, making it possible for you to still use that handheld transceiver under the most, under conditions where, that are, you know, that, in other words, you're so close to the target that, that you still can use, in other words, make use of the handheld transceiver, Dick, even one that isn't basically well shielded, over.
Very crafty. And one of the things that you should know about when it comes to a mixing circuit is that the mixing circuit will declare whatever is the strongest signal as its local oscillator. If I've got a mixer that is really starved for LO, it wants to see plus 10 dBm of LO, and I'm giving it minus 10 dBm of LO. But the RF signal is 0 dBm. It will declare the RF signal as the local oscillator. It's still giving you the desired products, just that its linearity of input versus output, input signal of 146 megs, and in your case, 145.52 versus 146.02, it'll be a little bit disturbed in its linearity when you interpose who is the local oscillator and who is the RF by way of amplitude. But it still does the function. And as you adjust that knob on the potentiometer that's injecting the amount of LO into that mixing stage, you're still going to be acting as an electronic attenuator of the signal you want to listen to at the offset frequency into your handy-talkie. Very crafty. It bypasses all the shielding requirements of the whole system with this very simple little plastic box you hang on the antenna port of the handy. Quite a good idea. Bernie, K2YO, go right ahead. K2LIW in the TechNet.
I just wanted to mention there's a couple of, two concepts. Number one, there is a gentleman, I believe he's in New Zealand, somewhere down in the South Pacific, who makes a package about the size of an HT that has a receiver, an active attenuator, and everything built in. It's reasonably well shielded, and a lot of guys are using that directly with their tape measure beams for sniffing applications. And my understanding is that you can get pretty point-blank range onto 30, 40, 50, 60 watts with no problem and be feet away from it and still be actively hunting. The other concept I want to bring out, I know some guys out west that are doing mobile carb-based tea hunting where they're using big quads or big quad antennas, are using active attenuators now and have developed automatic active attenuators so that basically as they close in, as they get more and more signal, once they get a full scale, they've got a circuit or probably a processor built into the product that knocks down their attenuation. So all they do is drive and keep hunting signal, and then they've got an output telling them how much signal they're getting so that they get some indication of when that they're actually there. So once you, this type of an application leads very well towards automating the attenuation process where you don't need to worry about kicking in more attenuation as you get closer. It just automatically does it for you.
Yeah, a number of the military receivers I've worked on have what I call a gear shift, where they throw attenuation into various portions of the receiver in order to stop overload from happening when the signal you're listening to is very strong. In the case of a radar, there are some really superpower radars out there where the peak pulse power is billions of watts. And as you fly your airplane close to that radar, your electronics goes bonkers. And so it takes other functions in order to restore the dynamic range. There's a whole lot of reasons why you might want to know the specific amplitude of the signal you're listening to on your surveillance reconnaissance receiver or on your electronic countermeasures receiver. You want to know the amplitude as a method of getting rough range calculation, direction finding, and so on. So in some cases, they throw in attenuation in various places to increase the dynamic range for strong signals. In other cases, they have a directional coupler on the antenna output port, which goes into a separate log detector, detector log IF system, which has much stronger signal capability. And so beyond a certain amplitude of signal, you no longer listen to the main output of the receiver. You listen to the auxiliary output from this directional coupler and log detector that's up front. These are some of the techniques that have been used. I know that this particular club, Long Island Mobile Amateur Radio Club, well, back in the early days, back in Mel and my time, so to speak, they used to have frequent fox hunts, and some pretty fancy techniques were being developed. I'm a little disappointed that not as many fox hunts take place recently, and there's good reason for doing that. Not only is it educational electronically, but there are times when an extraneous signal comes along, you want to find out where it is so that you can inform the user of that particular piece of electronics that it's creating interference, and therefore eliminated from the receiver front end of your particular repeater. Let me drop.
KTKY, one more thing I want to say there.
Okay. Mel in a second, and that is a friend of mine who's in the commercial service is doing a high power, high technology radio work with reference to cell phones. Needed direction finding information as to what's the best way to do it, particularly if the signal you're listening to happens to be a broadband noise generator. It's not a simple sinusoidal local oscillator and modulator, so to speak, where you could tune a receiver to it, then a receiver has a signal strength indicator, and you put some kind of a directional antenna like a Yagi in front of it, and you wave the Yagi around and figure out the direction of arrival. Well, if the signal you're listening to is broadband noise, some other techniques are required. And talk to anyone who's done a significant number of fox hunts, and you realize that the electronics is only half of the solution. You can have the worst, you can have the world's most expensive Doppel scanner, the most elaborate azimuth elevation steerable high gain antenna system on your vehicle, and you think you're going to be a real good fox hunter, and you put that particular piece of hardware into the marble canyons of New York City when a intentional or unintentional fox is doing his work, intermittently transmitting broadband noisy signals, and you rapidly realize that the experience of doing multiple fox hunts and how to properly interpolate, interpret the apparent azimuth of arrival on your instrumentation. I mean, the apparent azimuth of arrival will wave all over the place as you drive up and down Fifth Avenue, so to speak. And mentally, you have to integrate and figure out what is really going on and picture in your mind the way the signal is bouncing off the buildings in order to figure out where is the true source. K2KEY, I bet you've been on a few fox hunts in your day, Mel. K2LIW in the TechNet.
That's even on the military, even on the military end of it. Now, this simple system like the ham radio, you don't need much anything else other than that LO and then a buffer transistor control. You know, you can do it all with about maybe a dozen parts. Very simple thing to put together. No sophistication required, really. The military version, or I should say the commercial version of it, they go into a little more of a fancier device, which actually uses a double balanced mixer, and then a matching pad, and then a filter network. That's the ones that they use for commercial use and RDF in military use, Dick. I won't go into too much more on the air why and where this was used, where I saw it, but they do have a very effective unit that is commercially made by a company that is in the military electronics. But, of course, I had to sort of delve into how the heck this thing works. That's basically how it is working, with a double balance mixer and matching pairs and filter network in there. They're quite sophisticated, but I don't think you need that in ham radio, over.
Yeah, with the work that I've done with doubly balanced mixers, and nowadays mini circuits will sell you some for rather inexpensive prices. And some of the doubly balanced mixers have a transformer-like device, usually a toroid, for the local oscillator input, another toroid for the RF signal input to a quad of diodes, and then a simple output connector for the IF output, which does not have a transformer in most cases. And by way of putting a DC current into the IF port, the one that doesn't have an isolation transformer, you can use a doubly balanced mixer as a very precise on-off switch, which can have an attack time and a decay time in the picoseconds, fractions of a nanosecond. And I've used that phenomenon. Second of all, when you're using it as a mixer, where you do have a real RF and a real LO going in, and you get an IF signal going out to your receiver in this particular case for an offset attenuator, by pouring direct current into the IF port of the mixer, you're starting to saturate the diodes. Their mixing action starts decreasing, as long as you don't exceed the current that creates damage. And so you don't even have to attenuate the local oscillator. Or you could do a combination. Attenuate the local oscillator and or plug in direct current to the IF port to desensitize the mixer. It's the opposite of common sense. Whenever we build receivers, we always want to make the receiver as sensitive as possible to have the lowest noise figure as possible so that it can listen to the weakest possible signal. When you're doing fox hunting and you're real close to the fox, the signal is so darn strong because Mother Nature's inverse square law, every time you half the distance between you and a source of signal that's propagating through the air, you get 6 decibels of signal change, a 4-to-1 strength in milliwatts of signal change every time you half the distance between you and the source. So as you start getting real close, the signal starts climbing in amplitude very fast. And to desensitize the receiver so as not to saturate it, as I said, is opposite of all of our training, but it's the real-world environment for fox hunting. The terminal home mode of your fox hunting operation...
Repeater, timeout.
The terminal home mode of your fox hunting operation needs these kind of techniques. You're about to ask, where do those words come from? In the case of certain kinds of ground-to-air missile, when the missile is tracking the target and steering its vanes and trying to get closer and closer to the target, it then needs another set of circuitry that gets turned on, which lets it know when it's at the target so that it can do its thing of exploding and creating damage. And so that circuitry, and when you turn it on, is sometimes called the terminal home mode. And so there's a minor version of that when we do fox hunting. Anybody have any further questions or comments, give me your call letters right now. K2RIW on the TechNet.
K2KEY, one final thing.
Mel recognized. Anyone else? I want to make sure that the machine dropped long enough in case anyone else wants to sign in out of area. You got it, Mel.
Okay. And besides using this attenuator, Glenn brought up a very good also use of the body. They call it body stage. That's the terminology in fox hunting and bunny hunting, when you're using your body to give you a sort of a null-seeking situation. So by using body fade along with this attenuator, you'd be amazed how accurate it can become, Dick. So a couple transistors and then a little smart of how to practicing and using your body as the other factor for the body fade, and that usually makes for a very easy or a very accurate hunting of
of a hidden signal source. Over.
Yeah, part of what's going on there is that the attenuation your body creates at 144 and 432 megacycles, for instance, is an extremely effective one. You might ask why. You've heard Mel and Dick tell you a lot of times in the past that when a strong radio signal hits your body, for 60 years people have been investigating what happens. Common sense would lead you to believe that the signal is going to be rectified by all the wiring of your body, and the nerves are going to be picking up that signal and getting false alarms and doing funny things. You can easily come to that conclusion, because if you grab a high tension wire, like the 110-volt socket in your house, if your hand comes in contact with it and another portion of your body is in contact with ground, you get some tingling sensations and other strong things happen real fast. So it's very easy to think that there is a non-thermal effect. Well, after 60 years of research of radio, reasonable signal strength radio signals, I'm not talking about the amplitude you've got dead center in the middle of your microwave oven, or dead center into the waveguide of an operating radar. There you've got such a fierce amount of radio signal that, yes, you can get some very peculiar effects. But any kind of reasonable transmitting antenna and receiving location for you of some reasonable power. We're not talking about a 50-megawatt radar here. We're talking about a 30-watt police transmitter. And you're standing on the same roof with that police transmitter, and you're walking up to that antenna. And you might ask yourself, what happened? And the answer is, when the RF energy hits a human being, it gets turned into heat. Let me drop. By a much smaller version of what happens inside of a microwave oven. A high percentage of a human body is made out of water. And water is one of the world's best radio frequency absorbers. Obvious by the fact that Mr. Southworth, way back in 1938, when he was writing his book on microwave techniques, and he was doing experiments with waveguide, what he did was to take a long piece of waveguide that looked like a piece of downspout. He put it at a slanting angle into a great big trough of water, so that inside of the waveguide there was a wedge of water. And he rapidly discovered that the RF energy would go propagating down the waveguide, hit that wedge of water, every bit of it got absorbed, and essentially none of it reflected back to him. So a simple wedge of water, not a solid wall of water, a wedge of water in a waveguide is a beautiful attenuator. Well, that water that's in your body is another wedge of water, so to speak. The water molecule is a bipolar molecule, dipole molecule. In other words, if you could make the water molecule, two hydrogens and one oxygen, sit still long enough for you to measure it, you would find out that the two hydrogen molecules, your common sense would lead you to believe they're on opposite sides of the oxygen molecule, because the two negative polarity objects are repelling each other, you would think, and they would be offset by 180 degrees. Well, for a bunch of complicated reasons, those two hydrogen molecules are only offset by something like 109 degrees. In other words, one of them's at the North Pole and one's only 109 degrees away from the North Pole of the oxygen molecule. So one end of the oxygen molecule is negative, a water molecule, one end is negative, one end is positive. When you expose that water molecule to a radio wave, the molecule tries to follow the polarity, the instantaneous polarity of the wave. It tries to flip back and forth at 146.85 megacycles, and it can't do that. It can't move all the way. It does it with a phase lag. That phase lag is called the hysteresis effect, and it is the loss mechanism by which cooking takes place in your microwave oven. Well, at a much smaller signal strength, that radio signal that you're exposed to when you're standing on the roof of this building that contains a police transmitter, for instance, that radio energy that hits you, the
repeater, timeout.
The water molecules of your body try to follow that signal. They can't do it, but they absorb its energy and turn it into heat. And the only thing left to discuss now is how many centimeters down into your body does the radio signal penetrate? How much heating does it create? And how much potential grief could that give you? One of the very severe, very highly measured parameters of a cell phone is called SAR, specific absorption rate. in order for you to sell a cell phone in the United States, you must provide measurement laboratory information traceable to the Bureau of Standards, confirming that the human being using that cell phone slapped up against the side of his head while he's talking into its mouthpiece and listening to its earphone, that the specific absorption rate will be at a rate less than 1.6 watts per kilogram. If you took a kilogram of human being and you transmit the 1.6 watts into that human being, it creates an amount of heating of approximately a tenth of a degree, I think it's centigrade, it might be Fahrenheit. And the testing agencies throughout the world have come to the conclusion that if you raise the body temperature by one-tenth of 1 degree, that they have a lot of evidence saying that no damage occurs. Now, you don't actually make the measurement with a kilogram of human being. You make it the measurement with the nearest cubic centimeter, 1 gram, but you rate it in rates of watts per kilogram. So in the United States, a cell phone will not exceed 1.6 watts per kilogram. It's interesting that in the United Kingdom, they're allowed to go to 2 watts per kilogram. And yet it's in the United Kingdom that they got the very conservative suggestion where they tell you it is suggested that you not hand the cell phone to a 5-year-old child to talk to grandma, because the 5-year-old child, being so young, his cells are forming so rapidly that there is an increased risk that the RF energy might do something deleterious. They've never measured it, they've never confirmed it, but they have a feeling that to be on the conservative side, they recommend you don't let a 5-year-old child use a direct cell phone as opposed to a so-called hands-free. So that 1.6 watts per kilogram, United States standard, which falls very close to the 1 milliwatt per square centimeter.
Repeater, timeout.
As you can see, there's at least two different methods of measurement of radio exposure. You can set up a flat plate of absorbing material, and you can measure power flux density. That's a fancy way of saying watts per meter or milliwatts per square centimeter. So how much energy crosses that plane of that absorber? That's power flux density. If you assume that the absorber is a volumetric object, like the human head, which a good human head is a couple of pounds of stuff with a lot of water inside, by the way, and you could rate how much wattage gets absorbed inside the human being, and you rate each individual cubic centimeter as to how many milliwatts gets absorbed, and you put it all together as to what is the absorption rate, SAR, specific absorption rate, in units of watts per kilogram
tonight,
of human being.
8 o'clock. Welcome.
Yeah, this is the killer. This is the 8 o'clock thing that's being advertised. You're listening to it right now. It's amazing that that runs also during the TechNet. So, let's see now. How did I get into this one? Oh yeah. Now that you recognize the fact that RF energy, particularly between the frequency range of 30 and 300 megacycles, the so-called VHF frequency region, happens to be where human beings are most absorptive. Of all the RF energy that hits you between 30 and 300 megacycles, a high percentage of it, 90-some-odd percent, gets absorbed and turned into heat. That's all it does. It gets absorbed and turned into heat. So since your body is such an extremely good absorber at that frequency region, it's obvious that when you hold your handy-talkie in front of your body and turn your body around so that your back is aimed toward the fox that you're trying to hunt, your body absorbs the energy coming from that fox, doesn't get a chance, just a little bit of it crawls around the side of your body and gets into the handy-talkie, or maybe some of it bounces off of an object that's in front of you and then bounces back into the handy-talkie. By that circuitous path, you're creating a tremendous amount of attenuation. So you can see the tie-in here now between cell phone power flux density, cell phone specific absorption rate, and fox hunting with a handy-talkie. Once you recognize the fact that water-bearing